The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at The Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's The Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Book and Film Globe podcast. I am your host, Neil Pollack, the greatest living American writer and the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. We cover the worlds of books and film and streaming TV and much more, and we are a product of Sea of Reeds Media. Thank you for joining us this week. We have a great show, very informative show this week. Stephen Garrett, our chief film critic, is just back from the Sundance Film Festival, still warming his feet up. Apparently it was very cold in Utah this year, and he has a report from Sundance about the sort of sad vibes there and also some of the not-so-sad movies. Really, he still seems to think the movies are vital. He's maybe the last man alive who does, but that's why we love Stephen. We love his writing, and we love talking to him about movies, and he'll be along in a bit. But first, we're going to talk about developments in AI and in AI when it comes to movies and voice acting and digital image generation. Very interesting developments. There's been some controversy around this Oscar season, and there are some new sort of government sort of guidelines that have been issued about AI and movies and the creative process. And our business correspondent, Stephen McCauley, is here to talk to me about it. And we'll talk to him right after this interlude. The most newsworthy or the most buzzworthy development in the Oscar race has been the controversy over the Netflix film Emilia Perez. The star of that film, Carla Sofia Gascon, has made a bunch of, I guess you call them bad tweets. And that's very, very buzzy, but I don't feel like that controversy, while it is juicy and fun to read about, is going to have, you know, sort of long lasting implications on the film industry. And to me, a more interesting and relevant and long lasting Oscar controversy, which is a much smaller one, involved this sound enhancement to Brady Corbet's The Brutalist. There was apparently some adjusting to the Hungarian dialogue that Adrian Brody and Felicity Jones spoke when they were ostensibly speaking Hungarian, and there's been a little bit of outrage about that. Stephen McCauley is one of our contributors, and he writes frequently about the movie business for us, and he wrote an article about the Brutalist AI controversy, and he's here today to talk to me about it. Hello, Stephen.
Hi, Neil. How are you?
I am well, and my voice is not been adjusted by AI. This is what I really sound like, and you've talked to me in person, so you can attest to that.
It's very true.
Yeah. So explain a little bit about why this was controversial at all.
Well, I think in some ways it's mysterious, and you opened by talking about, you know, the Oscar contention, and I think that we should go back to Sunday night, because something very significant happened then.
Sunday night as we're talking.
Sunday night as we're talking, the Grammy presentations, okay?
Yeah.
So now and then, a previously unreleased Beatles song that had John Lennon's voice from 1978, which was adjusted by Peter Jackson and his crew, and then worked by Paul and Ringo, and they added in George Harrison's guitar, and lo and behold, this wins the Grammy for Best Rock Performance. So this is AI. This is what AI did to music. When Nirvana came out with the 30th anniversary edition of In Utero, they openly admitted they used AI to make it sound better. So, you know, as we look at the situation with The Brutalist, I mean, it's the same thing, basically, okay? In this case, they used an AI tool, Respeecher, and they used the voices of the actors, but the AI was able to adjust it based on parameters of the way Hungarian speakers would be able to more closely identify it. So again, it's like, okay, Brody and Jones said, okay, fine, let's do this. They gave permission. So it's, you know, within the SAG-AFTRA contract.
Yeah, well, you know, and it's not like they used AI instead of Hungarian voice actors. I mean, Brody and Jones were at least attempting to speak Hungarian, right?
Yeah. So, yeah. And, you know, and the thing that it also I find to be rather curious is that, you know, we take CGI for granted in movies, right? So, you know, you can't possibly see a Marvel movie without seeing minute upon minute, hour upon hour of computer-generated stuff. So the question then becomes, why is this different? Well, I mean, it is different in terms of what the capabilities are and what it can do. But by and large, pre-October 1927, you didn't hear people speaking in movies. So, you know, what happened? Was it like, you know, some devil technology came in terms of recording capability, and suddenly we heard, you know, the jazz singer? I mean, this is the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that is, I mean, I think that most sane people will agree. And, you know, you talk in your piece about how Robert Zemeckis used Reese Beecher to de-age Tom Hanks's voice, but it was still Tom Hanks's voice.
Right. Now, this is not to say that you can't create completely artificial characters, that you cannot create a digital Tom Hanks that the actual Tom Hanks has no relation to. You know, they can do that, and they probably will do that. I mean, that's the thing that I think people need to come to grips with, is this understanding of how, you know, motion pictures were transformational in terms of, before the movies, you saw actors on stages, correct? I mean, you couldn't see them anywhere else unless you went to the stage and saw them do the performance.
Right.
Technology marches on. Lo and behold, we are now sitting in movie theaters across the country, across the world, sitting on airplanes, wherever we want to be, and we can see those actors doing their jobs just as actors were doing on stages. So again, it's just a technological advancement. Now, the question becomes, what does this do for, employment?
Well, right. And you bring that up in a lot of your pieces. So I wanted to pivot and talk about this thing you mentioned in your recent piece about the U.S. Copyright Office. They released something called Copyright and Artificial Intelligence Part 2, Copyrightability, which is not really a great name for a sequel, but it is very interesting. Sort of, it just shows you sort of where our legal framework is at, right?
Right. So, okay. So basically, you know, what's the deal with copyrights? And so basically, the purpose of a copyright is a writer, as you well know, Neil, because I mean, you've done this many times. You know, you write something, you want that protected. You want that to be property that you are able to sell. And you don't want me to be able to take exactly what you wrote and then put my name on it and sell it. Okay, so that's your protection by the government for your work. Now, another reason that the Copyright Office exists and goes over these things is basically for me to say, let's say, okay, Neil's making money off of this book that he wrote. I think I should write a book so I can make money too. Okay, so what the Copyright Office actually wants to do is encourage the creation of more art. Okay, and this art should be created by people. So the question then becomes, okay, we have AI. To what extent can a writer or a visual artist or a filmmaker use AI to create something that then would be protected art? And what they basically came up with is the idea that, okay, this has to be created by and large by a person, not by a computer.
How do they determine what percentage was created by a person, though, or people?
Well, that is the very, very good question. It's basically that the Copyright Office, when this becomes a question, is then asking the individual who is submitting this claim to provide the documentation which would indicate the percent or amount of human input?
Well, I ask because, like, I could go to, you know, OpenAI or DeepSeek or Grok or any of the sort of or Bing and say, write a short story in the style of Neil Pollack. I have played with that before, and they will produce something that is at least a reasonable facsimile of my work, because apparently my work has been some of my work has been fed into these machine learning tools. So, I mean, I guess if I submit it and I say I wrote it, you know, none the wiser, but, you know, it's an open question, right?
Well, okay. But here's the thing, Neil, I would put in to one of these AI systems, write a story in the style of Neil Pollack, and then I would put my name on it and try to sell it to the copyright office.
Right. But you could probably get away with that, right? I mean, I doubt that someone in the U.S. Copyright Office, I mean, no, I'm not like that well known. Someone's going to be like, oh, that reads like an AI-generated Neil Pollack ripoff, but it's got Stephen McCauley's name on it. I mean, do you really think they're going to be able to sniff that out?
Well, I suspect that what would end up happening is if you then were to stumble upon this and say, oh, wait a minute. Yeah, this sounds like me.
Then you too will know the pain of not selling very many copies of your work.
But you could probably sue me and then make money off of me for pretending to be you.
Yeah, that would pretty much bring my career full circle. But I mean, okay, me aside, like really, like I feel like this is more applicable to film and to filmmakers, right? Like, because you know, it basically says this decision or this paper that the copyright office put out basically says, you know, filmmakers can use AI as much as they want, right? They can use it to, not as much as they want, but they can use it to enhance. They can use it as a sort of like a visual aid, right?
Yeah. Well, a large part of this then is dealing more with the writing of the work. I think we're pretty comfortable with the CGI aspect of, you know, what's going on, you know, and like the aforementioned Peter Jackson. I mean, can you imagine if you took all of the computer generated imagery out of Lord of the Rings, what would be left?
Right. Or Avengers Endgame or Avatar.
Right.
Yeah. Or Dune or any of the blockbusters that, that we know and love. I'm interested in this deal that SAG-AFTRA struck with this company Ethovox. What you explain that a little bit?
You know, part of the issue is, you know, going back to the Now and Then Beatles song. Part of what AI can do very, very well is voices, and there are a lot of voice actors out there who, you know, we don't know who they are. We don't necessarily know their names, but, you know, this is how they're earning their livings, right? And so the question then becomes, okay, if Joe Blow, who happens to be a voice actor, decides he wants to use his voice in a way that he can sell it to a company that they can then make their own commercials using his voice without Joe Blow having to sit in a studio and reading, they can do that. So it's basically SAG-AFTRA said, okay, you know, we're going to sign up with this AI company that does voices, and they will be very ethical and they will protect Joe Blow's voice as well as anybody else's voice that chooses to sign up with them.
Well, whether they're ethical or not, there's a legal agreement. So the legal agreement will force them to be ethical, right? So so what's his name? Your fictional voice actor will be guaranteed some residuals if they use his voice in a commercial or a trailer, or, you know, if they decide to use him as a sort of a voiceover character in a TV show or movie, right?
Right. And you know, and to get back to the situation with Tom Hanks in the Zemeckis movie, I mean, there had to be an agreement by Tom Hanks that he could be de-aged,
yeah,
for his image and likeness to be used in that movie. Okay. So conceivably what you could do is feed in, you know, the complete works of Tom Hanks into one of these machine learning systems and then say, do a movie starring Tom Hanks landing on the moon, and the movie could be created, but without Tom Hanks' permission, that would be illegal.
On the other hand, but what you're saying is, like, let's say you create a completely AI generated and written movie and voiced movie that is not copyright protected. If there's no human hand involved other than, you know, providing prompts, right?
Well, that's my reading of what the Copyright Office said. And I mean, basically one of the questions that came up was, you know, when you were doing, asking an AI system, you put in a prompt. So this goes back to the, you know, write the movie of Tom Hanks landing on the moon, or write a story in the style of Neil Pollack. And some of these can be very elaborate. Well, basically, a question that came up before the Copyright Office is, okay, if somebody writes this, you know, lengthy, elaborate prop and a work of art comes out at the other end, is that copyrightable? And the Copyright Office basically said, no, it's got to be largely done by a human being. The output has to be largely created by the human being. The human being has to have his or her hand in it in some way.
Yeah. All right. Well, it's a brave new world out there in content land. And we're covering it on Book and Film Globe and have been covering it kind of extensively in the last couple of years. And a lot of that coverage has come from Stephen McCauley. And he is always available for consultation on these things. And I appreciate the fact that you are staying on top of this. So I don't have to, man. I don't really want. I'm happy to edit the pieces, but man, I'm glad I don't have to write them. So thank you.
Thank you, Neil.
You're not using AI to help you with your reporting?
No.
Okay. Well, I'll have to take your word on that. Stephen McCauley, thank you so much.
Bye.
Stephen Garrett took his annual winter vacation to Park City, Utah this year to go to the Sundance Film Festival. We talk about the Sundance Film Festival every year. I don't go. I never go. I never go anywhere, really. I go to the bathroom.
Oh, that's important.
Yeah, several times a day. Stephen goes to film festivals, though. He probably goes to the bathroom when he goes to film festivals, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the Sundance Film Festival. And, you know, Stephen has wrote a couple of articles for us covering at great length the movies he saw at Sundance. But before we talk about the films, Stephen, let's talk about the vibe, right, at Sundance. You know, you made your first article in particular made it sound kind of, well, first of all, sad. It's sad, right? The Sundance is going away.
Wah. It's like a sad trombone, yeah. There's a little of a like, oh, you guys are still here. It didn't help that it was very cold. It was like a very cold Sundance, which is kind of unusual because it's been fairly warm these past few years. But yeah, I mean, there were fewer places to congregate. The places to congregate were outdoors and it was cold, so people didn't, you know? And then you didn't really get a sense of a festival hub or center. I mean, they closed down Main Street if you wanted to schlep all the way up there, but there's only one screening venue up there at Main Street anyway. It's the Egyptian. I don't know. You didn't necessarily feel welcome. It's not like people were unfriendly, but it did get a sense of like a bar that's closing down, you know, or that's starting to close. Like 1 a.m, being like, guys, you got another hour or two, and then I'm closing. I'm kicking you out.
You got another hour or two before movies go away entirely.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I got that. I read your coverage of it. I read coverage by my friend Richard Rushfield from The Ankler. I read some other pieces, and it just kind of all sounded kind of, it just sounded like the end of the party.
It's a little bit. I mean, you know what? And unfortunately or ironically, like the movies were solid, if not really good. You know, there just weren't any big, like, star-driven vehicles, which sometimes is for the better because there was a rule of thumb there that if there was a movie star in it, that it probably wasn't very good, but it was playing because they wanted a movie star to be on the red carpet. But there were definitely some really, really strong films. It just didn't feel like a place that was celebrating them the way that it used to feel.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think that that sort of goes hand in hand with the culture in general. We don't celebrate movies like we used to.
Yeah.
So it makes sense. Sad but true. But well, let's at least talk about the movies, because you know it wasn't just a festival where you could stand outside and drink overpriced beer. Although I'm sure that was available if you wanted to. But there was this movie, the grand jury prize, right? It's the biggest prize you can win at Sundance. Went to something called Atropia.
Yeah, it did. Yeah.
What is that?
Not the best movie playing at the festival, but it's certainly a movie playing at the festival that I guess checked enough boxes that made people decide to give the grand jury prize. I mean, it is a pretty weak anti-war satire in the vein of MASH, but, you know, a fraction the amount of vitriol and wit and caustic comedy, you know. But it stars Aliyah Shawkat as an actor who is playing in this sort of immersive military training ground that actually exists in real life and in California, called Atropia, which is, it's almost like Westworld, except for soldiers. You know, they go there, they're immersed, they get a sense of what it's going to be like to navigate narrow streets and have a lot of people speaking in different languages at you and everything. And this is set in 2006, so it's kind of the height of the war on terror.
I mean, there are neighborhoods in Los Angeles you could do that in.
I know, you kind of could. I mean, that's the thing. It just felt, I mean, deliberately it's dated, but it's also all of the jokes that they had were 20 years old, which is to say they weren't quite relevant. And they also felt like they were told secondhand by people who did not live through the war on terror the way that you and I had. And actually, there were quite a few movies that came out at that time that were a lot more incendiary. This is not that. This feels watered down.
My experience of the war on terror was the same as my experience of COVID, where I was just getting into arguments with people on social media. it seems like that's the universal constant in whatever traumatic generation altering social event happens. Well, all right. So, and this wins the grand jury prize, and it doesn't have a distribution deal.
No, nor has it since. I mean, there are three movies that got picked up, which probably have the biggest chance at kind of breaking through and having people talk about them.
Yeah, let's talk about those. Let's talk about Together.
Yeah, Together is this movie by filmmaker
Michael Shanks.
Michael Shanks. And it's a body horror film. So it's kind of in the wake of movies like The Substance, there is, I guess, a sense that there's an audience for this. And so it's commercial enough. And Neon paid reportedly as much as $17 million for the rights to it. It has Alison Brie and James Franco.
Dave Franco.
I'm sorry. As soon as I said that, I was like, probably wrong Franco. Dave Franco as a couple. Of course, they're married in real life. In this movie, they're not. Actually, that's a plot point early in the movie, is that they aren't married and they're not yet. And so it's a relationship under duress. And they both are kind of reevaluating if they're meant for each other. Are they willing to commit to each other? They're having issues being intimate, and they stumble into a cave that has some freaky juju that's kind of religious cult adjacent, and weird stuff goes down that deals with their literal physical attraction, to the point where things get icky. Let's just put it that way. But it's a funny, it's harrowing, it's sweet. It's romantic in its own weird, sick way.
Are there things coming out of other things?
There are things coming in and coming out of other things. Let's just put it that
way. Can't see it. Yeah. I can't see movies where things come out of other things. I don't think
it's gross.
Hollywood doesn't seem to understand that if they want my business, they've got to stop making movies about werewolves, and they've got to stop making movies where things come out of other things.
So, that is going to be, you know, a great date night movie.
People are going to see it. It's going to have the opportunity to see it.
It is horror adjacent enough that Neon, which made a killing with, so to speak, with Long Legs last year, that they're thinking, oh, this is great. There's an audience for this. We can make our nut back, so to speak.
Yeah. And it's a marketable, Together is a nice marketable title.
Totally marketable. It's high enough concept that it's going to do well. And it's smart. It's fun, you know. Right. The other big deal was Netflix, and all they said, I think it was Deadline that reported the deal, being in the high teen millions. High teen millions. I don't know.
Yeah.
But anyway, this is a movie by Clint Bentley, who had a beautiful movie called Jockey a few years back in the festival. And this is his follow-up called Train Dreams, based on a novella by Tennis Johnson, with Joel Edgerton starring as a turn of the century logger, like turn of the century, 20th
century. Turn of the 20th century. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I think he was born in the late 1880s, his character, and you follow him through his life, mostly in the first part of it, but it takes you right up to 1967. And it's very much one of those like vanishing Americana sorts of movies. Hmm. It's narrated by Will Oldham. No.
Will Oldham?
No.
The indie rocker?
No, it's not him. It's another one.
Will Forte?
It's not Will Forte.
Will Ferrell?
It's definitely a Will. It's a gorgeous movie. I mean, it's beautifully shot. Beautifully narrated. It's kind of astonishing. It's quietly beautiful in the best way.
You mentioned Terrence Malick in your review. So, you know, the thing about Terrence Malick movies and movies like Terrence Malick movies is they're I always admire them. And I always have a nice nap in the middle of them. I like films that like are both good and can provide a nap.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, somebody I think really cut to the heart of Terrence Malick movies, where they say if you turn the sound off, it's the most beautiful film you've ever seen. If you close your eyes and just listen to it, it is the stupidest sounding movie you've ever heard.
All right. Well, that's Train Dreams, and that's going to be on Netflix up against, you know, the latest documentary about P. Diddy and serial killers.
Well, it's great. And there was a bit of a groan among the Cinerati when Train Dreams bought it. I mean, when Netflix bought Train Dreams, just because we all kind of felt, oh my God, now it's going to get memory hold. It's never going to be shown on a big screen in a theater where you can really focus on it. You're not going to be distracted. Because it really is one of those movies that just lends itself to just this kind of epiphany. You want to cry quietly in the dark at the beauty of this person's life, you know, and the tragedy in it, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, Netflix picked it up as a sort of prestige play, award season type movie. So expect for it to pop up again. And then the most recent deal is this movie, Sorry Baby, that got the most genuine buzz in terms of it being a discovery film where Ava Victor, who's a online kind of a YouTube comedian. Mm. Have you heard of her?
I have not. I have now.
Kind of a cringe comedy comedian. She wrote actually wrote, directed, and stars in this movie, basically exploring one woman's trauma after a sexual assault that happens on a college campus, where she ends up actually working as a professor as well. It's a little, the chronology is shuffled a little bit. So it's hard for you to kind of figure out quite what happened or what effect it had on her life.
Are you telling me it is a non-linear narrative, Stephen?
It is non-linear.
Well, it's not quite as bad as Things coming out of other things. That tends to be a non-starter.
But I think it's interesting. You know, it's kind of like a Manchester by the Sea sort of vibe movie. And A24 picked it up for like $8 million or something. So that's definitely going to pop up again. And it really is. It's one to watch. She's a very talented filmmaker, actress, writer. I don't think the movie is perfect, but it does have just enough moments that are kind of caught me by surprise and made me think, wow, that's something I haven't seen before.
All right. Ava Victor, Sorry Baby, Stephen Garrett recommends it highly. You also, one of the things that you do, I mean, what you do at Sundance is you go to movies. You go to a lot of movies. Some people go to parties.
I went to a couple parties. I can party.
I know you can, but some people go to parties more than they go to movies.
True.
I'm not saying you can't throw down with the best of them, Stephen, but you saw a lot of documentaries this year, at least if your pieces that you turned in are any indication. Is there, you know, documentaries tend to be, talk about getting memory hold.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right? This is not the golden age of seeing documentaries. There's good documentaries, but I'm just saying, like, it's not like, you know, 2004 where like people are going to see documentaries on the big screen very much.
It's not quite as fashionable as it used to be. That is for sure. And yet, actually, the documentaries, which is very normal for Sundance, is that the documentaries are among the strongest things, most radical things, most interesting things in terms of the filmmaking, in terms of subject matter. And this was another case of that. I mean, there was a movie called Perfect Neighbor, which is stitched together almost entirely from body cam footage from police. And it's very much one of these neighborhood conflagrations that turns fatal between a white woman who kind of is a Karen type character who is very angry and frustrated. And
we call them they're now called Margarets. That's changed.
Are they Margarets?
Margarets, yes. Like as J.D. Vance said in some interview recently, I don't care, Margaret. So now they're Karens are now Margarets. But go ahead.
Well, she has some next door neighbors, or rather across the street neighbors, black and brown mm-hmm. neighbors who play in an abandoned field across the street, which happens to be right next to this woman's house. And so she is put upon, she's annoyed by it. She calls the cops repeatedly. They're kids who are being kids, so they're loud and unruly. It just kind of escalates and gets worse and worse and ends tragically. But what's fascinating is that there's no documentary film crew there. It's just all body cam footage. And usually we're used to seeing body cam footage of like bad, you know, whatever, not bad boys, but what is
of arrests. Cops. Bad Boys is the theme song.
It's the theme song. It's usually the points that are the most sensational. This, you're actually seeing these kind of long interviews with the people as they happen. And you realize more and more what's happening in between the lines of the dynamics among all these people.
And the police let the director use the footage.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, and it becomes this really fascinating sort of indictment of stand your ground laws, because the woman that was killed was shot through, like the Margaret character, shot this woman through a locked metal door and said, oh, my life is being threatened. Well, how was it being threatened? Like, you had a locked metal door. And it deals with a lot of really interesting issues, but formalistically, it's really fascinating. There's also this movie, The Alabama Solution, that Andrew Jarecki co-directed, rather. And he's the one who did The Jinx all those years ago. This is, again, from a formalist point of view, it's fascinating because most of the footage is shot by inmates in the Alabama correctional facility system. I think there's something like 10 or 12 prisons. And the conditions are terrifying and absolutely heartbreaking and vile and disgusting. I mean, the abuse, the physical abuse, the drug abuse, the everything. It's astounding. There's a prison system where, you know, twice as many incarcerated people are in the prisons than there should be. And there's about a third of the staffing that's needed in order to actually, you know, make it a humane situation. This has been going on for years, and this is a real indictment.
And the state of Alabama allowed this stuff to get out?
It's interesting. The movie was actually added at the last minute, quote unquote, probably a few weeks before the festival started. It was announced that it was going to be there. And part of the reason it was delayed was because of, I think, a certain amount of blowback from lawyers in Alabama. But it's an incredible film and totally worth watching. There's another that's called 2,000 Meters to Andreevka, which is directed by the guy who did 20 Days in Mariupol.
So a Ukraine war movie, basically.
Ukraine war movie, exactly. Yeah. And it's about a bunch of Ukrainian soldiers who have to retake a Russian-occupied town called Andreevka. And it's about the 2,000-meter journey that they had to travel through. This kind of war-torn landscape that honestly looks like World War One. I mean, it's just totally burnt out, blown away, you know, shelled to death. But it's, in this case, it's GoPro footage that's right on the helmets of each of these soldiers. So it literally feels like Call of Duty. I mean, it's fascinating.
But isn't this interesting? You've got documentaries that are using body cam footage.
Yep.
That are using, how do they get the footage in the prison, in the Alabama prisons?
Cell phone footage, smartphone.
Cell phone footage, GoPro footage.
Yeah.
You know, that. You know, the cameras are everywhere. And so smart filmmakers are able to use the technology and make movies in very in sort of interesting. Because, you know, the thing about the old cliche about documentaries, and it is a cliche at this point, is that the crews are very intrusive, right?
Absolutely. You know,
every sort of fake documentary TV show is all about these intrusive crews, and the crews end up becoming characters. And so, like, that's not possible in this case when you're, like, really, like, just kind of fishing footage out of reality, basically.
This is,
like, it's like a whole new way of a whole new wave of verite.
It's an absolute whole new wave of verite from a financial point of view, too. I mean, think about it. Yeah. It's just like you don't need a camera crew. It's like the footage is existing. It's basically found footage in a weird
way. Challenge is getting the right footage and putting it together in a compelling way.
Yeah, absolutely. And then really quickly. Zodiac Killer Project is...
Yes, I wanted to talk about that.
Hilarious, because it's a movie where, like, it's a documentary about a... made by a filmmaker who was a film critic, so it's a more analytical study of kind of true crime movies, but it's a documentary that really kind of... And it's wall-to-wall narration. He's just narrating through this imagined and failed attempt to adapt a book that is about the Zodiac Killer, which he couldn't get the rights to. So he kind of describes what he would have done if he had done it. And he actually stitches together all these shots, all these cliched shots from like a dozen, two dozen true life, you know, documentaries that have been, you know, kind of mushroomed up over the past 10 years or so. All of the classic ones. I mean, I mentioned the Jinx earlier, that pops up, but like...
So it's like a meta documentary about the not making of a true crime documentary.
It just kind of calls out all the cliches of all of these things, you know, all the cultist true life docs, all the serial killer docs. And it's funny because, you know, he'll say like, you know, this was the church where he did it. And then he'll pause and be like, actually, this wasn't the church. I couldn't get it, but it was close enough, you know, or like here was a police station. He's like, well, it's actually a library, but it looks close enough and it's easier to film in here.
No, it's good. That's good. That's a genre that needs the piss taken out of it a little bit.
It takes a piss out. It's a bit of a spank on it, which is really great. It kind of gives it the spanking it deserves because it's, you know, for something to be quote unquote true, we know reality TV isn't true, but these true crime docs wallow in some real tragedy and they take a lot of liberties that he's calling out. So it's kind of thrilling.
All right. And that's called the Zodiac Killer Project. And the director is Charlie Shackleton.
Yes. That's all great. Right. British guy. Oh, and Will Patton is the guy who was narrating Train Dreams. Come on, Will Patton, give me, that's the voice you want to hear. That's a great voice. Don't you want to hear Will Patton narrate your life?
I'd be willing to hear Will Forte narrate my life at this point. Will Wheaton, like I said before, anybody.
Wills. Okay.
Yeah, I don't really care as long as my life gets narrated. All right, well, Stephen, we're gonna let you go. We're gonna let you go to your next.
I gotta go to another film festival, man. I can't stick around.
What's next? Where are you going next?
Berlin. I go next week.
Always. You know, your annual junket to Germany.
That's right. Yeah. Get some schnitzel. I love that place. It's wonderful.
Have fun there. And thank you. And I guess next year is the last Sundance, huh?
In Park City. Yeah.
And then after that, they're going to, where do you think they're going to, you're going to end
well,
up
having it's,
it?
Well, it's either Salt Lake City, Boulder, or Cincinnati. I'm kind of gunning for Cincy. Why not?
They're not going to have the Sundance. Who's going to go to the Sundance Film Festival in Cincinnati? Know. What are you going to do? You're going to go and lay a wreath at Harambe's grave?
Sure. I don't know. Should I? I will.
Yeah, you should.
I don't know.
You should.
Better than Salt Lake. Which would you rather go, Salt Lake City or Cincinnati?
I mean, of those three, I'd rather go to Boulder, I'd say. I'd rather go to Salt Lake City than Cincinnati for sure.
Wow.
In the winter, it's an NBA city. You know, the Cincinnati maybe in the summer. Yeah, I think I would rather go to Salt Lake City. It's nice there. There's good hiking. You know, it's nice. It's a nice town.
Well, they got options. Then we'll see. But you know, one thing's for sure. I think Redford is out. You know, I mean, he's 88. He did not show up this year. He's conspicuously absent. I think that added to the kind of the quiet nature of this edition. Yeah.
It's the end of an era. But Stephen Garrett is never the end of an era for you. There's always another film festival on the circuit, and we will talk to you either about one of those or about some other movie that you saw for free very soon.
But not the movies about things coming out of things. Hopefully not.
We can talk about them. I'm just not going to say them.
All right, fair.
All right. Thank you so much, Stephen Garrett. Have fun in Berlin and Vienna, wherever you go to see movies. Stephen's always jetting around the world in Jakarta, the Jakarta Film Festival. I'm sure we'll get a report from there. The Sydney Film Festival. Maybe he'll go to the first film festival, Elon Musk's Martian Film Festival. Stephen will be there if there is a film festival. Also, thanks to Stephen McCauley for talking about issues in artificial intelligence and the movies. Stephen writes a lot of really excellent business stories for us, and I'm always glad to have him on the show and in the pages of Book and Film Globe to inform you about that stuff. I'm Neil Pollack. I am the editor-in-chief of Book and Film Globe, www.bookandfilmglobe.com. I am not digitally enhanced. I am here in my fabulous original form, and you can listen to me in that form on this show every week. Thank you so much for joining me, and I will talk to you soon.
Original production. The Bookhouse is an independent bookstore with two locations in New Jersey, Millburn and Long Branch. Are you the guy who says they like to support indie bookstores? Good. Then be that guy. Come shop at the Bookhouse. Books, puzzles, games, coffee, cards, live author events, comedy nights, and most important, a real sense of community where actual human beings engage with one another. The Bookhouse in downtown Millburn and at Pier Village in Long Branch. That's the Bookhouse. Independent, local, quaint as fuck. Follow us on Instagram and come visit our stores.